You are listening to a Triple Canopy podcast. To hear more, visit www.canopycanopycanopy.com.
To protect ourselves from these those constraints, like other dangers, and let somehow a little grain of sand was insinuated into the flesh of each oyster. And this provoked irritation, resistance, and their obsession and devotion, and the oyster devotes itself to perfecting this object, which is it created inside itself by materials which are not its own, but not part of its natural, the fleshy part of the oyster. And so the idea, I mean, I don't use the word constricted form anymore. I use the general phrase.
I said constraint.
That's fine. Not the good expression of the rule of the game, or the rules of the game. And that this is the rule of the game is to create new growth and invention, not to take away the means of being present in the world. Because in this world, it's what you said, we are obviously participating in the world produced, even if it doesn't look like us.
Okay, and I know there's some people believing, because I was told there was some people believing, and I'm sure they're not hiding out.
Where each song had the same line of speech, fortress lines could be replaced by all of the fortress lines, by any of the other fortress lines, which already gave you a potential of 100 polygons from 10 original ones. And with each, and this is true of all the other ones too. So you end up with 10 to the 14th power, which is 100 million polygons. Anyway, I suppose that's one kind of potentiality. But another kind of potentiality.
Is that like a communal power? No. Because obviously not one person is going to write 100 million points.
No one person is going to read them.
No, but what you just said is a multiplier, a wonderful multiplier.
That's one meaning of potential.
And that suggests community, because I'm obnoxious or something. And if it suggests a community, are you saying something about the reader, who the reader is? It's a boring question, you know, when someone says to me, writer. Under your show said, I'm writing for the unknown reader, which I really have always liked because it suggests that the reader might be unknown to himself or herself. So obviously the person who needs it, I don't know who I'm writing for. But it's better than some other answer that I've heard. And so potential literature is, does it suggest an interaction with a large community? Because we both, it sounds like a group, and I heard you told me that one guy was rejected from it, right?
No, you can't be rejected.
Oh, you can't.
Well,
maybe there's another word for rejection.
You can be kept, if you want to be sure never to become a member of the Unipo, you ask to become a member of the Unipo, and that guarantees that you cannot become a member of the Unipo. That's an ambition, remember that.
Okay.
Our latest recruit, an absolutely fabulous man, a fellow American, Daniel Levenbecker, 23 years old. It's a huge breakthrough for us. Incredibly smart. He's the music critic of the Believer. I see very big reviews of groups that I've heard of. And that they're very interesting to read. And I don't know if he originally wanted to be a member, but he soon desired to become a member of the Believer. It was like someone courting the members of the Academy Française. You know, you go around, you call on all the members of the Academy Française and have tea with them, and so forth. And he did that with us, and he never, ever did he say, I would love to be a member of the Academy because he would have become, and now he isn't. But he's written a wonderful book about the movie, which is definitely bullshit.
Well, I guess I think what I was thinking of was the beginning of a word itself. I mean, if you're observing a Lucian physical tape, you have, in a way, the form of advantage, right? But surely part of writing, and I don't mean that you don't observe it yourself, is not quite knowing where you're going.
Oh, absolutely. But the having a form is, doesn't tell you where you're going to go, you know, I have where it's going to lead you. That's like why it's like a grain of sand in the ocean, and not like a, you know, a path you have to follow.
I know John Barth said that he never began anything without having a roadmap. But that was in response to something that John Barth had said, that he really didn't know what the next sentence was going to be or what it was like at all until he had finished the first sentence. So there's a division there which is not very clear. And I think probably the practice of many writers is to embrace both. You do know where you're going, you don't know how you're going to get there.
The nature of the rules that you are following does not determine the genre that you may have argued. I have a little example of that, but I forgot.
I'm going to go to the
Well, but you will answer it. And I don't mean to be quoting Oscar Wilde or Whistler. When Oscar Wilde said, I wish I had said that, Whistler said, you will, Oscar, you will. What I'm interested for is the beginning of things here, just for the moment. And I didn't want to get us into the corner of talking about artificial knowledge and forms, because obviously you begin with something, and you know where you're going, and you also know where you're going. And since Sam introduced this little masterpiece in a way which I have to take issue with you over, although he's historically perfectly accurate, I think I'm going to read the opening paragraph of it, and it's just say a word more. What happened was that in the climate in the late 70s, when we had 9 years before the book was done, a book called Women and Men came from me, which is quite long. And there was a period that Readers at various times. But then outside that, there is a population. That was the word that Howard Bark can use when you look at the book and say, it's a population of God. And this is a population of vignettes, of people you never meet again. You meet them briefly in 10 or 15 pages, and then you go back to them into cracks. And there was a story called Preparations for Search, which is one of the vignettes. And I realized, as I came to the end of the book, that not only could it stand by itself, but it was tangential to the book, and it was not a vignette, but it was not one. And so that's why I withdrew the book from Women and Men. It was, that's right. That's my story, yeah. But it's not a story. Yeah, but it's true. And so it was in the window for a long time. It was here. And why wouldn't it be with a title like Preparations for Search? It's a wonderful title, I think. It bothers me. It bothers me not because I think it's a long title, because I don't fully understand it, but also because it has to do with these endless preparations that we all know about. We all know. I'm going to do that. I'll get to that. You know, I'm going to do that. But the search is what is underway all the time. And so years went by, and then I was introduced to Janet Hyde, who is the proprietor of a small anchor press, along with her team, some of whom are here tonight. And she was kind enough to be interested in something. And I gave her the story. And since I did, it then became a volume of a chapter of a book. I realized that it really was still going to be. And so I learned to love it over again. And I think that the beginning of it is perhaps exemplary of beginnings in which you do know where you're going, and yet there's a sense of a tangle which gets deeper and which has to be somehow unwound. It reminds me a little bit of time of Seinfeld without the one liners, but that's not fair. It reminds me of that only because it's about a group of people who are in relation to their friendship and other relationships, and who seem to go in and out of them and are shadowed by the past and by fantasies. And it's the fact that it is said in the late 70s and the 80s when it happened, lost, and it has nothing really to do with the quality of the story. But I just want to read the opening paragraph, or maybe paragraph and a half, to suggest what the requirements for an opening might be. Maybe I shouldn't even say it. It was only money, but it was quite a lot of money. And I told him, I felt I couldn't let it happen. He just said he could understand. I said, what he did with the money is his business, but he let $100 to pay a detective to track down someone he just hadn't seen since he was 2. He looked me in the eye and asked if it was true what he did with the money was his business. What money, I said. And he laughed and said, didn't I mean whose money? person looking for his father, and then going online, and the private detective is in a way in the center of all of the story, and the story is not there. It has to do with the relationships that emerge among the people in the book. And I call it a novel because I think it is not a short story and it is not a novel, but also because the parameters of it are blurred in the best sense. There's a sense of resonating largerness, perhaps, at the same time, it's a bit compactness. So that's
never what that means. What that does, that opening is, it doesn't really mean what happens. You're opening up a few fields of possibilities,
I would hope. And more possibilities are possible.
No, but that's what I think is, we're going to spend a lot of time on beginnings, because I told Joe, we see a lot of beginnings, and that's when, why did you get away with murder? And you can put things over the reader without the reader even realizing it's happening. He hasn't even agreed to be reading the book. He's just sort of playing the role of the reader.
Actually, it's true, but it has to be the reader, not reading. So I'm reading it too.
Yeah. It doesn't mean we're reading it too, but we're reading it, but they're not there yet. And so you can slide things in the people on your list. And since we did that, I won't be mindful.
And if you go out in the eyes, can you, does anything come to mind? Well, I'm going to have a good question. Since we spoke, I have some of the beginnings of your wonderful novels I remember. And I remember one of the beginnings with some of the hand in the steering wheel.
This is the meaning of cigarettes.
Yeah,
the first chapter. What's he mean by supposed to want an explanation? He doesn't explain anything. The gabled house loomed over us like a buzzing stuffing in the flight. Even the sort of riding, with a lot of edge in the rustle of the gravel, smoothly condensed, and swinging streaks of light were flashed beyond us, a little pale bank of Japanese dogwood, where a man in a white dinner jacket stood, inspecting Alan's letter with a pen on it. A great deal happens there, And for me, the crucial sentence is that only people in the house knew about this kind of buzzard stuff and fight. I mean, there is no reason for that to be there, but it really sets the task next tone of the task. I just want to illustrate why the form one chooses does not determine the feeling, the genre, the idea of what issues can be reduced to that form. And this is a very short thing, because it's a case of freedom. It's called Franz Kafka and the Liga. The bastions of Riga enclose the old town in an irregular fireside column. At each of whose corners a great tower stands, barely higher than the rest of the fortifications, were projecting its mats a number of distance beyond their perimeter. Near the top of each tower lies a square platform surrounded by primitive walls rising more than 20 feet above it. A flight of steps leads from the platform to an observation post set level with the crenellation in the outermost corner of the tower. In the course of my tour of the northwestern tower, I decided to climb these steps in order to enjoy the view to which I imagined they would bring me. On the day of my visit, this proved a difficult undertaking. Still wet from a recent shower, the steps were not only narrow and slippery, maybe they were a calcareous of stone, 5 centuries in use, and worn perfectly smooth. There was a railing after I had progressed less than half my way, I found myself obliged, in order to stay balanced, to bend over and lean one hand on the third or fourth step in front of me, while with my other eye broke through restraining fissures in the rough-hewn wall on my side. Even this effective, undignified tactic soon had to be abandoned when gusts of wind from above threatened to blow away my cap. I finished my ascent more or less on my hands and knees, or rather my hand and knees, with my other hand clapped on top of my head, a posture that provoked derisive laughter from my companions below, although I scarcely heard them through the shudders of dizziness that by now had begun to afflict me. When at last I reached the vantage point so laboriously stricken for, I beheld, instead of Riga and the waters of the Baltic, only an unbroken farm, as dingy as a little newspaper under the clouded sky. Several weeks later, when I was back home, a friend of whom I had long ago showed me a passage of Hafner's notebooks describing his sojourn in there. One paragraph read, I decided to climb these steps in order to enjoy the view which they would bring me. On the day of my visit, this proved a difficult undertaking. Still wet from a recent shower, the steps were not only narrow and slippery, made as they were with a pair of stone 5 centuries of use and worn perfectly smooth. There was no way. After I had progressed less than half my way, I found myself obliged, in order to stay balanced, to bend over and lean one hand on the third or fourth step in front of me, while with my other I go through the same fissures on the rough-hewn wall on my side. Even this effective, if undignified, tactic soon had to be abandoned when gusts of wind from above threatened to blow away my hat. I finished my ascent more or less on my hands and knees, or on my hand and knees, with my left hand cracked on top of my head, a posture that provoked derisive laughter from my companions below, although I scarcely heard them through the shudders of dizziness that had by now been afflicting me. When at last I reached the vantage point so laboriously striven for, I beheld, instead of reading the waters of the Baltic, only in a broken fog, as dingy as a little newspaper under the clouded sky. I was angry. The captain had measured this experience with such unaccountable efforts. In saying this, I am not referring to his hat, which had nothing to do with my feelings. Or is something in particular. At more or less the same time, George and I had written in which the first half of the story was repeated virtually word for word. In the second half, so it was an identical form. The only difference between them, my guess is half and half, and his, it was Ishon called Navishets, and the other was meeting Navishets at 5 o'clock in the morning. And what was interesting to me is that in Pavic's use of this totally absurd way of writing a text, the aesthetic fact was enough for me. Whereas you will notice that in my version, there was a moment of resentment, anger, drama. And this is not just a difference between myself and the world, but I think it's a difference between American artists and European artists who are much more willing to accept, a very flat, neutral presentation, which is very hard for an American to do.
You're not talking about the reading. I was talking about the writing. You're talking about the actual writing.
Yes.
In opposition.
I once attended a lecture about pornography, one of the movies in Venice. Not in terms of very distinguished, and the lecture was a very good lecture. And he mentioned something. He said that porn films all have a very intense gravity moral. So, the choice of the form is to decide.
Are you saying here that this is an American thing that you wrote?
But I think even here, there's an attempt, I mean,
responded in the context of the treaty. There's an intent, an obligation, in a way, to be in a place that is made up in order to make the reader feel that ultimately it's not made up.
Uh-huh.
The story is called The Campaign Trail. Our people will say, if questioned, that they found the trail and left it unmarked all the way to the wilderness clear, where the two rivals were apparently unbeknownst to each other to meet. Less strange to each other than to this 40-by-50-mile parcel of land, so recently annexed by our neighbors to the north. Was it a rest stop, a soul-restoring brief detour for the woman and the man, our two warriors? Was it a sanctuary, wild or human? Was it a thoughtful retreat, we asked, not quite knowing if what must surely have been an unplanned get-together betrayed the fact that they read each other to the tea. No question as to the later hours. We have those on record. The earlier we have had to infer, for these two acted almost independently of us. And ahead of our plans for them in these closing weeks of the struggle, the fight with tooth and claw to the finish, if we believe in the finish, of this hunt for victory, for the other's inner flaw or failing, for some weakness in the jugular. Yet that they had arrived, we do know, at this targeted clearing of this new territory of ours along different routes, as if there might be two trails, two trials, as the Aussie correspondent said, and must have made camp at the end of the day, these blood rivals, if in fact it was not, as scripture puts it, prepared for them. What are they rivals for? We want still to see more surely, as if it were us. 2 years at it and each other, night and day, to lead the nation and lead each other in. Until now, at the several centers of command, it had seemed in all honesty that they could use some time alone in which to think, and in a beautiful, as yet unknown, untouched, in fact, just annexed parcel of our nation and the world. Quality time, we dare say, the very term and concept cited as we will see elsewhere by the man. A moment apart, of the public contest and its rigorous conventions. The great leap upward at start and finish of speech, a rolling and bulging of eyes to show the most white, extending the tongue wordlessly, what the people live for in their leaders. A need to know their feelings, not their thoughts, their childhoods and formative years, hobbies, promises, significant relationships and favorite food groups, so the people, wherever they are, can decide which one they want, not even so much to govern the nation as be there for them. A burden for the man and the woman warriors is to hunt the people's voice, and to be that voice, yet more to be believed. The woman who is coming from the southeast, we know from one witness to her vehicle 30 miles down the country. Whereas the man from the west and north and east could see, if that is possible, more forthright, yet elusive. Each in some unspoken silence need to be alone, and as it turned out, each are. Deserving to be alone in this passage, but what they or we deserve became moot long before the rights on which our nation was founded proved the fiction to be remade long ago, as each of our rivals in words, but more in deeds, has revealed along the road the endless pilgrimage, the trail, the way. Or what right does any of us have to anything at the end of the day, apart from what we claim to the death, if we believe in death? To know your target and set it free, we like to say. Yet lured they were, these rivals, and by curiosity, animal and mineral life, by well-advertised fossil wealth, history, silence, empty land, hours before we were the lands. And then by the very weather, forecast to be bad, threatening a hybrid storm never before seen if there be people in this freshly acquired real estate of ours to suffer it. I'm going to stop at this point. If you would know if I read two more paragraphs, and I'm writing about a night spent that Hillary and Barack spent together.
You want to see it?
Yes, okay. Okay, let's try to find the other. Yeah, I'm happy about that.
It's extraordinary.
Yeah.
You will let it come. That was something. And then
well, so that's a good one. Hillary's got her green animals. Well, it's nice to think of it, well, if she's been doing her job as well.
No, I don't know. Please.
And actually, so is he, especially if you read the part in this thing about Rome, so set the balance right. I want to speak in a place now. So maybe you don't answer. You're American. You're very much American. I don't know about that, but I'm not sure anybody is. But you spent a great deal of time. You spent a great deal of time in Europe and in France. And what I'm wondering, it's a coin question, but I wouldn't be surprised if some people here would be interested in hearing. If you think that, quite apart from your being not only fluent in French, but an unusual practitioner of the language, if you feel that living there, being there, has had some impact on the fiction you write. You're also a poet. I want to talk about poetry and fiction too, but may not have time.
Well, I don't know. The writing is hard to say. It had a tremendous effect on my attitude for the English language, my knowledge, my awareness of the English language. When you're living in America, as I was born and raised in America, and I think this is a problem that is a literary problem too for many Americans, is that the nearest foreign language, where it's the official language, where it's the normal language, is miles and miles away. English is what seems to come out of the air, the way leaves come out of the trees in the spring. It's what words are. The word for tree is the English word tree. And you may know learn in the course of example in Spanish and Arabic and French and so forth. But it's for us it's certainly the English language seems as though it were a like the original language. The words in action meant what they said. And if you go abroad, and especially if you go up to the sort of absurd evolution of the idea that you want to come to France and then you have to get a lot of stuff. I had this dream of mastering a foreign language, becoming, not really a French, but becoming a French language, or becoming an Italian language, and that I would be able to get away from all my juvenile delinquencies by shrouding myself in my mastery of this new idiom.
But you said to become a language.
That's what I said.
And that's it.
Not a person. Not a person. I said something to it.
That's the importance. I thought you were talking about learning to speak a language. So you're a person speaking the language. But you said you wanted to become a language, which is very. God, how would you write a story about that? That's interesting. To become.
You do it. And you do it.
I write a story called an excerpt.
That's what you do.
But you did.
Let me just finish up this one. Which is that when you are exposed to the absoluteness of another language, you then have to start thinking about your own language. It's no longer the natural language, which is inevitable, what you pose all around you. And you have to become aware of the relationship. You realize that it's all artificial, it's all arbitrary. There are many words from spoon, whatever. And so you then, as a writer, you start being picky. You start being careful. And you start listening to your mind. You never really do. It's just there for you. That's about it.
When you say I think of myself as writing almost in reverse, not to be like Shelley, who said to the house party people that he spent all morning giving in how I'm alive and taking back. Not quite the same. But I write sentences as if they were stories, if they are, and begin in the morning, let us say, thinking I'm going to begin here. And before I know it, I come back many pages, earning the right to be here. And it seems extremely slow, the climbing of the sentence. At the end of the year, there's quite a lot done. But I think that I'm not thinking of words so much as the arc of the whole sentence.
But that's part of my life, there's no, yes, it's not just a good habit. I have an habit that's it's the easiest thing to do, but the way you phrase the thought of the audience.
Do you think the way
you structure
poetic prose is like a bad phrase in my vocabulary, it seemed like an easy. But would you think that writing poems, which you do beautifully and expertly, perhaps through the day of tonight, of some mostly new poems, I think, does that have an effect on your prose? I think Mark Twain saying, making a super distinction between widening and writing books. He associated lightning with the work of imagination and prose, part of Mark Twain's prose. Whereas the work of the lightning, you can even call it a word, is a quick metaphor of the poet. I think that's what he meant. But is it another thing to do in addition to writing and prose?
It's a very good story. I was longing to write a poem, but I never had to read it up in the until I learned to write it with the same precision and intensity as I thought I would write poetry. And then after that, I wrote poetry in the last. What I said at the beginning of the last year, 2 years ago, I decided to relearn how to write poetry in a serious, and to learn it in a serious manner. And I always think I've been serious enough to quote, but also I haven't been thoughtful about it because I have a lot of my quote, which for me drew its value from being, not from being poetic prose in the sense you were. Mercury as something you could be manipulated into pure language. I'm going to stop there.
I don't think the question is how many words are there for question in Italian and French, or how many questions there are for question, but should we take a few questions?
What is the question? Yeah.
Josh?
Yeah. Harry, it seems like a lot of your stories have a central conceit. Can you hear me?
I'm getting there.
Getting there.
Yeah. Who's this for? Joe or me?
It's for you. Is it Josh stand up? A lot of your stories have as a central conceit this a cipher, a sort of a mystery. And obviously the question in the compass for why are you repeating this in the story about you can fit everything you need in your life into a sock, why a sock? I guess my question is kind of begins basically, which is what is the Bratislava, what is the Bratislava Spiccato? And if there isn't a thing that the Bratislava Spiccato is, what did you think it could be while you were writing that story?
Well, I describe it as, I mean, what do you mean by
I mean, how are you thinking about it, that it is actually a technique, a violent technique? Are you thinking about it the entire time that it was a mystery that every person had to find out for themselves? I mean, you were writing it, what was the mystery to yourself?
It was a long time ago. My second building story. It seems to me, I describe it, you know, it's a way, I think I said it was a way of bouncing the ball of the string's driver. You know, which may not be a complete answer, but at least gives you some idea of what I'm saying. And the spiccato is a normal musical term, normal, it's probably a vocabulary. And what can I say? It was, I plunged into that story. Out of an awareness of the unbelievable, almost incestuous, genealogical relationship between musical families in Eastern Europe. And, you know, the names are all real, but the individuals aren't.
Yeah.
But all that part is made up. And there had to be something, well, there again, you know, to make it a dramatically American story, there had to be something that would crystallize all the other information in the story. That's not the point of the story. The drama is not the point of the story. The point of the story is this accumulation of names, and in the story they're all related to contemporary people who were then contemporary musicians. And so there's this the real it's the texture of the story which is the subject rather than the actual discovery of the transmission with this of this technique to you know, a rabbi on the platform that brought this up. So I don't know if that answers your question, but it was maybe a simple way of saying it was that I had no idea what I was doing. You know, but you get it to work, you know, and that was that's what matters.
I have a question about storytelling and not storytelling. One of the many fine things you said about my work, I think I understood this, but what you're just saying reminds me of it. You set up a great storyteller, a great non-storyteller, and I thought, I assumed that meant not that there were bad stories, but that in the telling of the story, there were reaches of something else in narrative. There were reaches of something else. Not like Melville in Wales, but is that what you meant? That there are areas of the story where the spinning of the yarn is beside the point?
It seems to me that we can reduce these spaces of narrative calm if there is a strong narrative supporting on the other side. I don't think it's the essential thing a writer has to do is to get a sentence to write. And he took this very kind initiative. And he wrote a story I wrote shortly after George Perec, who was my very close friend at the high. And he did what was very, very useful about it. And he used to say, look, you can make this better. And we should be otherwise. That was science, and that was incredibly difficult. This sentence is about it. And actually, it's something that, you know, it's not something we notice, and it's something that just, it works so well.
And if I may say so, you have just introduced me to Kara. We had a couple of meetings.
That's a whole.
And then, you die.
Drama. Yeah, that's what I meant.
So speaking of teaching, I have a sestina here from the class that I took with you, but I wrote in 2 hours, which I could read. Maybe that's appropriate. Maybe more questions would be more appropriate.
You know,
since sentences are so important, maybe we should have a yearly prize for the best time.
No, but one sentence doesn't count.
They're so important, of course it can.
Syntax, which is, you know, really limited to the sentence, in my view, applies to the succession of sentences, the succession of paragraphs, and this is, for me, the locus of meaning. Right? Yeah.
It's like a super syntax.
Yeah, I mean, it's just the idea of syntax extended to a
integrate. It's just adequately. That's why you begin where you thought you were and realize that you haven't heard it. You have to go back further and say, you know what I'm saying. Rocky used to say, a bit gnomically, and I'm not even sure that he knew what he meant, but he said, there is the outer sentence and there is the finished. It works better in the long sentence. With Jesus wept, but the outer sentence and the inner sentence. And as I wouldn't call it theory, but I feel that it doesn't really matter what people say if you can make something out of it. And I may not know what Dorothy ever meant. I felt that I did, because it struck somehow. And I thought, yes, a lot of my elaborate sentences in which you begin, and then in the middle, this is a subordinate clause. It's a different geometrical space. Something that comes to exist in the sentence, so that you almost lose the outer framework, and then you come back to the outer framework. But I think that that's helpful. Maybe inner here means an unexpected meaning, an unexpected meaning that surprises you. The best things come halfway through. That's what Frost said about a poem. But you can say about it, please.
You talked about beginnings. We have to talk about endings. And I think that that's, in both rules, that's a very interesting problem that you set up. And it's, I mean, closure and anti-closure, whatever. It's, you know, what does the end mean in any piece of writing?
In my case, in general, it sort of destroys the work that's just taking place. And, it seems to be back to the awareness of that they've been doing and reading a book. And I want to read you a very short kind of a story, which is called China. And it's like, it doesn't really matter. And it's this description of an extraordinary woman's role in the world and how she would ease in it, how she would dominate it, how she would escape from this obligation and so forth. But this is an example of a very short, of the very, very end, having a kind of surprising effect of saving a kind of a poetic effect for the very end. And she's sitting in the front of the building, depending on the city where she says that she you could, you know, go back down and look at that city and be broken as a woman of this perfect child, as a woman of great desires, her objects and desires. You smile with pleasure at the prospect, with pleasure, but not much curiosity. You watch two cars follow each other out of the suburbs of your country lane. At a three-way fork, one car turns left, the other right. Both cars stop, drivers get out, and the brakes in the middle scream. Each of them sure, perhaps not in any way. They'll figure it out if they can order their own. As for you, you know the way and not the way of women. This is the gift they were shown to bring you, the women, to be no longer sure. For seeing only that anything can change, that their things change. That the red sun will blacken with snow, the blue sky whitened with stars. You know, it's like a kind of anonymous images at the end.
Well, it opens up all these possibilities and makes me
think.
Well,
I think it closes them all down.
No, I don't think so.
But you say that you need to come to rest, but you need to come to rest still in some continuum of energy.
Well, I didn't do that for you.
But I thought about Grace Taylor's story, conversation with my father, in which the argument between them exists on many different levels, one of which is she wants to write a story that ends with the possibility for change, and he says, you're not looking tragic in the face. You're not looking tragic in the face. And it's I'm sure many of us have read that story. It's a brilliant story about writing stories. And I wondered what you thought about that kind of problem of an ending that
my favorite quotation about
a lot of people writing think that that's what they do.
Damn right.
it's a translation of the words.
Well, that's the whole world.
We didn't get this years ago.
We didn't get it. We didn't get it. I don't think it's the title of this. That's a little bit.
Say something.
No, I think we should.
I said something about my talk to the preparations for search. This was a film that was in the house, and when it came out, I was told by a young woman, I was told by this young woman that in fact the title was wrong and it should be on the house. And I said, well, first of all, an actor has to suggest a man. And second, the book is written from a 20-year-old guy in his late 40s on a searching page. He's just a guy. It's not a bad show to take, but a woman who is on stage is an actress. That's what the book is about. So it was interesting that title had that reaction.
So,
yes, I mean, to see that it could be an actor.
That French feminists differ radically from American feminists. American feminists want to eliminate sexual distinctions in professional titles. The French are going the other way, for instance, who is the modern feminist? Who is the one who made the fuss? Said she was tired of being called Madame Le Ministre. And she said, I would be called Madame La Ministre. That's to say, to make it very clear that she, that the minister was a woman. And the French have many, and for many professions, and Docteur, and it's not only a piece of it, Docteur Esque. They didn't want to make the point. You couldn't go to the character of that. No one knew about the surgery. No one.
Your main character's a male, so he's really doing an act. He's acting out. I saw a couple of people on that.
No. I thought it was so frightening because it was going in the
TV. I wasn't even aware that they had to be proud of it, just was the actor called. And this is unfair, but it's real in my position. It's only an actor. The difference between an actor and a story is only an actor. When this book was in Dallas, it was given to a very well-meaning young man, whom I know that, who every time my point of view character used the word girl, and sometimes he said young woman, but sometimes he said girl, because it's 2004. And he would say girl, he would think girl, he would. It's not a good job. She changed girl to young woman, it's the same. About 80 times, I had to restore all that. And that to me became the story. So it's interesting how much people have invested in the jokes of certain things. And I was ultimately sympathetic.
But you would be realistic about what the guy was thinking, right?
Yeah, first of all, yeah. He would not be saying
it. Quick question about titles and amounts of communication more. Do you pronounce it a loop or a truth?
The book?
What is the title?
Truth.
This is a loop, okay. There's no mistake there.
Carrie's thinking of titles and also endings. I'm hesitant to ask for people who haven't read the book, but I wonder if you want to say something about the sinking of the Underdeck Stadium. Odrada, thank you. A lot of pronunciation questions tonight. I guess my question is, when I read that novel, and I don't know what to talk about in it, at a certain point I thought, oh, he must have. I imagine a certain scenario where you thought of that title and how it's generally used in the novel, And that might have been the spark of the entire work that I could see with that title. I don't know what I was going to talk about that.
Yeah, no, it wasn't the concept of the word in the book. Even before that, I usually think of all the time of trauma titles. I took that because, first of all, what was sinking was the stadium. Well, it didn't, right. Didn't fool very many people. And then the, you know, when it shows up, in case you forget it, I don't want to move away and move it around. But anyway, it shows up, you know, and you realize that all was lost. But I had an interesting time with truth. And it's French translation. Because Georges Perec was a very ingenious word manipulator, rituals of language. A bit of interesting equivalents, for instance, d'entité, like identity without an I, identity meaning, you know, two things. It's literal, you know, and we went through several of those things, and he said one day, well, I think it should be called the Green Mustard Fields of Afghanistan, which is the last line of the section of the book, or chapter of the book. And I said, no, it has nothing to do with it, what do you mean? And he waited until I was in America, far away from Venezuela, and he was in cahoots with the assistant directress of Venezuela. And he decided that was the best title, and just sent me him, I don't know what it was in those days, a telegram perhaps, you know, this, the Green Mustard Fields of Afghanistan is the definitive title. And so I was somewhat twisted. And it took me years to realize that they did exactly the right thing because it works exactly the same way as truth does. That is to say, you have this title floating over the top of the page of the book, you have this title hovering there. And all it means, you know, what truth means, you know, what it is. There we go to Afghanistan, you know, further away from the book. You have no idea whether those titles are there. And suddenly they appear in the text. And the point and their usefulness is that at that point, the reader is radically reminded that he's reading a book and not reading an account of something actually happened. It's the use of the title as an active element in the text itself, which is what I like the most. I mean, I think it's one of the nicest things you can do with that. And I carry on a little bit further with cigarettes, because there are never any cigarettes. it doesn't even appear. This is, you know, why?
It's a kind of character for the reader. Constantly, it's kind of a character for me of reaching forward, trying to like, hoping they're going to eventually reach that, figure out what the title means.
Yeah, that's right. You're absolutely right. Yeah.
Not a question, but I just wanted to say that sound I discovered you in the 90s. I was reading through a mix of Perec's works across the great ones and the
things
that I'm going
to say. It sounds fascinating. Yes, it's a great one. Obviously, it's good.
I won't say it's a kind of
like 600 bucks for and even the transcript, I apologize to myself to say that I'm very worried about being hemmed in by the form in advance. At the same time, that I'm lured by that. My first novel is called A Smuggler's Pilot. And I was writing my first novel, and you put too much into the first novel. And you're maybe not sure about the shape of it all, but you have a will to get the anything done. And so I embarked on what really was imagined as a little practice. And very soon, I realized that I was in that the song of the Bible was an extraordinary metaphor for what I was doing. An empty Bible in which drum or jewels would be spoken, you know. And so my book would be, you would not open it too soon because things would fly out of it. My book would be a box. What could be more crude as an image of form than a box in which there's a bunch of stories? That's the way it began. And I think it was almost the crudeness of the metaphor that made me like it, because I realized how resistant I am to having a pre-arranged form sort of shadow. And so I think I like to think of the story emerging from inside, making the form.
No, well, I'm just going to add this that can, because, for instance, in Women and Men, there's no difference between women and men. It's these different, you know, triple parallel stories which generate the form of the book. That's a form of form. It's a kind of form which is not the box at all. It's more like a little grain of sand.
Grains of sand. That's pearls of wisdom. Thank you. Stick around.